Good afternoon. I'm going to call to order the Commerce Committee of February 13th, 2019. I believe a quorum is present. So with that, do I have a motion? Has anybody had a chance to take a peek at the minutes? And is there a motion to approve the minutes from February 12th?
Go ahead. You can take it. Okay. Madam Chair, I've reviewed the minutes and will move their approval.
Thank you. Representative moves approval of the minutes of February 12th. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Elkins. We have one bill on the agenda today, House File 136, and one of our members, Representative Stevenson. So, Representative Stevenson, I will turn it over to you. You can move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would move that the committee re-refer House File 136 to Government Operations.
You said Government Operations?
Yes.
Sorry.
Government Operations.
Thank you. And do you have any amendments? Oh, just a moment. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a procedural question, if I might.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. You were kind enough when we began the session to bring in folks from the gambling control area and liquor control and insurance and other areas. But we didn't get a chance to hear from the telecoms and the internets that are represented in Minnesota. Was that, are you planning on bringing folks in? Because we are taking up a pretty major piece of legislation. That background on that might have been helpful for members, just wanting to know what the landscape looks like as it relates to that topic.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. We did start the session with a number of overviews. Now that we have bills and deadlines in front of us, I think that we are going to do fewer overviews and more conversations in committee. And I do know that members have gotten to do a lot of one-on-one visits with the industry. So that is more typically how we do things in commerce, but now that we have bills in front of us. But we're happy if you feel like you'd like to find a day to schedule, we could find a day to bring people in, but looking with our deadlines in mind.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. It's not my job to schedule. That's the job of the chair and the committee staff to do that. I'm just asking for background, because this is going to be pretty complex stuff. Because we've been dealing with this on and off, you and I have been on the committee, and I just want to make sure that everyone who's on the committee really knows, because it's going to get, the waters are going to get deep really fast as to what's going on with this particular topic. And I just was wondering, and maybe in the way of a background, it might have been helpful. And I guess I'm going to hope that the people who are coming here to testify today can maybe help with some of that in the conversation, because this is a pretty heady bill that's ahead of us here today and has some pretty long-range consequences. And without having that background at a bachelor's degree before you go to master's and into a PhD level on it, I just want to, you know, just kind of see what the landscape was on it. So,
And just for your review, the overviews that we did were really about state oversight and not from the industry necessarily themselves, other than when we did get a little more background on how healthcare financing system works from the healthcare payers. But new Commissioner of Commerce did kind of lay out how we oversee telecommunications in the state of Minnesota, and so that was a piece of what we focused much more on state oversight than we did from the committee. And I actually have a lot of faith in the conversations that members have been having about these issues and other issues that we're going to be facing here now that we're rolling. So thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could, one more thing, and I don't mean to belabor the topic, but I do want to just point out that we did do a bill yesterday to extend reinsurance, and we did have quite an extensive conversation with individuals from the health insurance industry and representatives from that. And I would put this bill at that same level. That would have been nice to have some of a deeper background for people before they were to hear it. But again, that's the prerogative of the chair and the scheduling. I know that from having been a chair myself in the past, and so I will defer to your judgment on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Stevenson, to your bill, you can move your bill to get it in front of the committee. You did.
I have an amendment.
Okay, thank you. Had to get back on track here. And this is an author's amendment. Would you like to move your author's amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A1, the A1 amendment at this time.
Okay. Representative Stevenson moves the A1 author's amendment to get the shape in the bill in the shape that he would like. Is there any discussion to that? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Two-year bill as amended, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It is hard to think of a more significant consumer protection issue in Minnesota today than the need for net neutrality. Given the amazing power of the internet, how it has come to impact literally every corner of our lives, it is absolutely essential that every Minnesotan have access to a free, fair, and open internet. Today, internet service providers have the power to decide, free from any limitation, what we see when we open our browsers. Never before in our state's history has any private company had such incredible power to shape the public's understanding of the world around them. Without net neutrality, internet service providers have the unchecked power to pick winners and losers in our economy, in our culture, and in our very democracy. They can speed up your access to websites that feature products they favor. They can block your access, or even just slow it down to the point that it effectively blocks your access to services they dislike. Huge established market players like Facebook can enter into agreements with internet service providers that ensure that their websites reach consumers at the highest speeds available, while startups and small businesses, lacking the money and market power to negotiate effectively, are left in the slow lane. Internet service providers will tell you that they have no interest in doing any of this. Indeed, many will say that they support net neutrality, but just want one standard for the whole country. But these same companies have invested huge amounts of resources in fighting net neutrality in the Congress, at the Federal Communications Commission, and every state capital where it's been considered. Actions speak louder than words, and the huge investments these companies have made in fighting net neutrality at every turn speak for themselves. The bill before you today contains essentially two provisions. First, it enacts net neutrality into our state statutes and makes it illegal for internet service providers to engage in anti-competitive, anti-free market, and anti-consumer behavior. The second provision prohibits the state from doing business with any internet service provider that does not agree to act in accordance with net neutrality principles under penalty of perjury. The idea that huge internet service providers can make decisions behind closed doors and without limitation about what information the American people have access to is frightening. All Minnesotans deserve to be able to access the internet on their own terms, not those dictated by private corporations. And Madam Chair, I would now like to ask Dr. Joe Constan, a professor at the University of Minnesota, to come down and testify a little bit about what net neutrality is and why we should care about it.
Thank you, Doctor. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joseph Constan. I'm Distinguished McKnight Professor of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of Minnesota, where I also serve as Associate Dean for Research in the College of Science and Engineering. I'm not here speaking on behalf of the university, and I'm sure you're very relieved I'm not here seeking anything on behalf of the university, nor will I comment on the merits of a particular bill or its language. I don't have the legal expertise to claim to do that. I was asked to give an introduction to net neutrality, where it is, where it came from, why we should care, and perhaps address a few misconceptions, and I'll do that as briefly as I can, and I'm happy to take your questions. From a technical perspective, net neutrality simply means treating the data that travels on the internet the same, regardless of who it came from or who it's going to. That when you're sending a picture, we don't know whether that picture is from you to a family member or from a corporation to you where you've arranged to pay for it at another time. And at the beginning, that was just the nature of the internet. All packets of data were treated identically. It wasn't a design decision so much as it was the natural effect of technology. But over time, for the internet to be practical, it has evolved a set of different protocols so that video, for instance, can be treated differently from text being sent as email, and particularly real-time services where if it's not on time, it might make sense to drop it. But none of us would want our email, if it can't be delivered in half a second, to just disappear. And so there's nothing about the concept of net neutrality that prohibits treating content differently as long as it's treated differently for technical reasons that have to do with the nature or protocol it's traveling with. Video might always be treated with higher urgency but lower total priority than email if a network did it, and do so neutrally whether the sender of that email was Google or my mother-in-law. The idea of net neutrality and the concepts as we understand them are something that goes back a long time with the notion of utilities, which is something I'm sure this committee knows far better than I do. But the concept that when we're talking about a public utility like the mail, first-class mail gets delivered the same no matter what's in the envelope and gets delivered at the same time and at the same rates. We do the same thing for private companies with power. You don't have to pay a higher price for your electricity because it's going into a Macintosh and people with Macintoshes are rich and can afford it, or because it's going to recharge a hearing aid and medical devices. If you can afford them, you can afford more for electricity. You pay the same whether the electricity goes into your dishwasher or whether it goes into, you know, your local supercomputer that you happen to have pulled out of a garage sale. There's reasons why internet service providers might want to abandon this concept. The obvious one is there's a huge amount of money in the internet. There's a lot of commerce going on. There's an amazing amount of advertising going on. And if you find out that Google, through YouTube and Google Search and Facebook and all these other companies, are getting their share of all this advertising, it seems a little strange that the fundamental core without which none of that would happen doesn't get to get a piece of the action. That is how we treat utilities and how we treat what we think of as basically public or quasi-public services. It's also the case that commerce is a big deal here, but the roads don't get more money because expensive stuff is driving over them than cheap stuff is. That's how we've chosen to do things as a society, and I'll come back to that. In turn, I think it's fair to say that there can be creativity and investment where there's revenue. And ISPs have argued nationally about investing in creative new services that they can only afford to do if they're able to create these alliances and get paid in one way or another. Now, when we talk about people's support for net neutrality, there are almost always two stories. There's a consumer story, the end user. I don't want to have to pay extra for certain services. It's not clear that that would happen automatically. It might not be me paying. It might be the service paying to reach me. But if we look at the examples that exist in domains that don't have these protections, if you take your cell phone data and you get your cell phone from a particular provider, you may get unlimited data for a certain music company and not unlimited data for a different music company. That's already being done in the U.S. If you go in parts of Europe, there are places where you can get a different package if you're not willing, if you only want their preferred services, you can get a small version of the internet, what some of us are old enough to remember as, you know, the old AOL, right? We don't need the whole internet. We just need the part that was approved. There's also a business side here, though. Minnesota companies have a stake, new ones and old ones, in not being discriminated against. Think of, since I'm from the university, I won't use our example, but think of the Mayo Clinic, which does amazing work with distance medicine. Do we want to be in a situation where we're supporting an internet where an internet service provider could decide, well, we want a preferred arrangement with the Cleveland Clinic? Their radiology goes through really quickly. You can do video conferences. But Mayo's going to have to pay extra to reach you, or you're going to have to pay extra to reach Mayo. Those are the kinds of things that you think about. Now, when I think of this all together, there's not an obvious right or wrong. This is part of why I'm not going to advocate for anything. It's a judgment call. And it's a judgment call on the degree to which you as a committee and we as a state think that the internet is a public, is dependent on public infrastructure and public investment, and the degree to which there's the lack of competition so that the free market can't solve this all on its own. We don't go out and regulate supermarkets and say you must carry Pepsi. Maybe people would only get Coke, but we trust there are enough markets out there that if there's a demand for Pepsi, Pepsi will be available in some markets and the other ones will have to face pressure. It's your decision to judge, is there really that competition around the state, in rural areas particularly, but also in the urban core, where this will solve itself? Or is this a case where we have to be really worried? And I'll give you just one example to close with, which is the companies that are involved today are very large companies. We have to ask ourselves partly what will they do purely out of profit motive But what will they do out of these alliances that are formed? I get my internet from Comcast. I get quite good internet service from Comcast. I get cable TV from Comcast. And it's been, as far as I can tell, unbiased. What would happen the day that Comcast realizes, wait a minute, Comcast, aren't we the same company as NBC? And wouldn't it be better if, when he tries to stream an MSNBC article, it comes through fast? Maybe the Fox News articles we could slow down a bit so that we can help boost the MSNBC ratings over the time. I have no evidence this is being done. In fact, I'm pretty confident it's not being done in Minnesota today. And I don't think there are any executives that are going to get up and say that's what we're looking to do. But I worry that when profit motives are there, people can get remarkably creative in the things they do. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Freeshaw.
Are you? Do you want questions now with the testifiers, or do you want us to call them back up? I just a couple of clarifying things as I was listening to his testimony.
Representative Freeshaw, I think we have typically hearing bills in this committee started waiting till the end, making
fine.
Sure that
whatever
we
you'd like
everybody. So thank you, appreciate that.
You want
so
to do all
I
of
hope
them
that
or
the
just...
can testifier can stick around if questions arise. Thank you. Yep, we'll go through all the
thank
testifiers.
You.
Does that work for you, Representative Stevenson?
Yes, Madam Chair. And
Chair, go ahead, Representative Stevenson.
The next testifier is John Gordon, the Executive Director of the Minnesota ACLU.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is John Gordon. I'm the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota, and I am here on behalf of other people in addition to myself, too, and that is our 40,000 members and supporters all across the state of Minnesota. The American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that has been working to protect the civil rights and civil liberties of the state of Minnesota and the people in it since 1952. Thank you for the invitation to address your committee this afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to support House File 136 and to support our great state in joining the more than two dozen other states already working to protect net neutrality in the face of federal inaction and gridlock on this important issue, which affects the way that all of us participate in our civic discourse and participate in the economic life of this country. Information and communication are the lifeblood of democracy. When they are permitted to flow freely, our democracy grows and strengthens, just as the blood flows through freely throughout your body. When they are blocked or inhibited, just as happens with human beings, democracy slowly dies. The Federal Communication Commission's decision in December of 2017 to grant Internet Service Providers, or ISPs, the ability to decide what online content is permitted to travel on the information superhighway in the high-occupancy vehicle lane, what information is relegated to the slow lane, and what information is prohibited from using the on-ramps at all. It presents a significant threat to democracy and the freedom of all Americans, and in particular the freedom of the people in the state of Minnesota. Arguments by the FCC and some ISPs that the end of net neutrality would foster greater internet freedom and innovation, we believe, are absurd. The only thing that eliminating net neutrality did was to allow ISPs to engage in content-based discrimination. This is not hypothetical. This is not far away. This is not somewhere else. In the United States and elsewhere, we have already seen content slowed and blocked based on political views and business interests of ISPs, ISP companies. In 2012, AT&T blocked FaceTime from all but its premium data plans so that AT&T could market those pricier plans. In 2012, Comcast instituted charges for its competitors' streaming services so that it could gain a competitive advantage in marketing its own streaming service, hurting the free market in a very anti-competitive and anti-consumer way. AT&T censored a live Pearl Jam. Who would want to censor Pearl Jam, for crying out loud? AT&T censored a live Pearl Jam concert stream in response to criticisms of President George W. Bush by the band's lead singer, Eddie Vedder, as to whose music I express no opinions, but it shouldn't have been done, and it's not right. Verizon blocked text messages from the pro-choice advocacy group NARAL because Verizon deemed them to be, quote, controversial, unquote. Telus, a Canadian telecom company, blocked the website of a union with which it was engaged in a labor dispute. And AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon all blocked applications like Google Wallet that competed with their own wallet applications. An overwhelming number of American states and the American people are united in their view that the FCC's elimination of net neutrality is unacceptable. More than two dozen other states have introduced net neutrality legislation, and four of those legislatures, Washington, Vermont, Oregon, and California, have already passed their bills. In addition, the governors of Montana, New York, New Jersey, Hawaii, Rhode Island, and Vermont have all issued executive orders to protect net neutrality. Bipartisan support among the American people is overwhelming. According to a 2017 poll by the University of Maryland, 83% of Americans favor preserving net neutrality rules that the FCC has abandoned. And that includes 75% of Republicans, 89% of Democrats, and 86% of independents. We encourage this committee to advance House File 136 and add Minnesota's voice to the chorus of states fighting for net neutrality, not only because net neutrality is critical to the people of this state, but it is critical to the functioning of the state itself. Have you ever relied on the internet to do your jobs, doing research, downloading content to improve your ability to find out what's going on in the world? I have. In fact, all of us rely on the internet to do our work and to do it well. You may have used the internet to prepare for this hearing. I did. But without net neutrality, ISPs can block you from viewing web content that favors net neutrality. They could slow your access to videos favoring net neutrality to the point that they don't even load correctly, and you might not even know it. I tend to blame the machine myself, but what's going on, if it's invisible, is very harmful and is not and does not allow consumers to make intelligent choices even about which ISP they choose. So let me conclude by quickly dispensing with three fallacious arguments that ISPs have been making in state legislatures throughout the country, because what you'll see is a coordinated effort by them to do just that in state legislatures. ISP companies are claiming that net neutrality legislation is unnecessary because they support net neutrality and intend to honor its principles despite the FCC's rollback. As I believe Representative Stevenson has alluded to, no industry spends millions of dollars lobbying to eliminate regulations just so they can follow them voluntarily. The ISP companies are claiming that it would be impossible to abide by a divergent set of rules passed by different states, by various states. Two things about that. In the first place, the auto industry succeeds in doing just that because there are different standards in different states. And different states already have different consumer protection laws, and national companies seem to be able to find ways to abide by them. But in the second place, and I think this is just as important, we are here today dealing with this issue in the Minnesota House of Representatives and the Minnesota legislature because the ISP companies have brought this on us and brought this on themselves by opposing national uniform net neutrality rules, and they have done that very successfully. So I suggest that it ill behooves them to ask you to save themselves from their own anti-regulatory handiwork. We would support, indeed the ACLU has supported federal regulation in this area, but the industry has stymied it. We and you are in this situation because they have put us in this situation. Last of all, ISP companies are claiming we do not need net neutrality laws because the FTC is going to enforce net neutrality going forward. The fact is that's just not happening. The FTC has neither the staff, nor the funding, nor apparently the will to do that, nor has it given any indication at all that it intends to. This country has enforced neutrality in the services that bind us together as a nation. And it's not a question of labeling something a utility. There are things that hold us together as a people. First, it was canals. Then it was railroads. Then it was highways. Then it was telegraph companies. Then it was telephone companies and telephone systems. And now, to a very great extent, it's the Internet. The Internet is how we relate to each other in the 21st century, politically, economically, and socially. We the people, not corporate America, need to take charge of ensuring equal access to the ties that bind us. If anyone is going to pick up the banner of net neutrality and move it forward in 2019, it is going to be the states, and it is going to be Minnesota, not our federal government. I urge you, the members of this committee, to vote for House File 136. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson, do you have other testifiers testifying on your behalf?
I do not.
Okay, well, we can move to public testimony on the bill. Tony Mendoza, Ann Boroff, Minnesota Cable Communications Association. I think that we have some technology. Okay, there it comes.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, representatives of the committee. My name is Tony Mendoza. I am outside counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. I've been practicing communications law for over 20 years. Former Deputy State Commerce Commissioner under Jesse Ventura's administration, and I've twice chaired the communications law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. But I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association to address House File 136.
And I just want to stop. Do you have about a timeline of what we should expect in terms of how long your testimony is? Or I see there's quite a long slide deck, so I want to be sure we have enough time for every testifier. So.
Yeah, I'll try to do my best to go quickly.
Okay.
I don't have a time frame, probably 15 minutes.
Okay, that might be a little on the long side, so
but
we want to hear what you have to say, so we'll just watch the time together.
All right,
thank you,
good,
sir.
It's a complicated issue. The question of how to regulate the Internet has been the subject of intense debate at the federal level for the past two decades, and actually even longer than that. The Cable Association supports net neutrality principles and would like to see this question resolved for good at the federal level once and for all. The important work by all stakeholders in this issue has Congress now well positioned to enact bipartisan legislation on this topic. The rhetoric, part of which you've already heard this afternoon, around net neutrality has taken on a life of its own. And it's a phrase that's used to describe just about every grievance that one might have about the digital economy. The purpose of my presentation is to describe some of the history of this issue, the regulatory history of the issue, explain why it is so complex and difficult to resolve, and why this issue is best left resolved to Congress and not on a state-by-state basis. I thought I'd provide a little bit of a glossary for anyone on the committee that's new to this issue. The term bias, which does appear in the bill, comes right out of the federal open Internet order and the subsequent repeal. It's often referred to as the Restoring Internet Freedom Order or the RIF order, defines a broadband Internet access service, or it's otherwise known to as BIAS, somewhat of an ironic acronym there. But that's an acronym that was coined in the 2016 Open Internet Order, and something that has kind of carried through to some of these state bills that we're starting to see. An edge provider, which is also defined in the bill, usually refers to companies that provide content on the internet, companies like Facebook, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, Mozilla, Tumblr, etc. And of course, an ISP is one of the groups I represent is an ISP, an internet service provider, and those are companies like Comcast, Charter, CenturyLink, and the wireless companies AT&T and Verizon. This issue dates back to the origins of, actually before the internet, to the 1960s, with a line of cases that the Federal Communications Commission started in the mid-1960s called the computer inquiries. In those dockets, the FCC, and this is when computers were starting to just become part of our lexicon in America, and we were still basically using local telephone service and long-distance services to communicate with each other. But the FCC started to realize that there was a difference between what computers were doing and what communication services were providing. And they wanted to provide an incentive for investment in what they referred to as enhanced services in that docket. In other words, data processing services that that didn't necessarily transport data, but processed it, changed it, transformed it so it could be leveraged into some other useful purpose. For communication services, for the pure communication services, they referred to those as basic services. Those two dichotomies, enhanced and basic, found their way into the Telecommunications Act of 1996 as two definitions that have come to be very important in this discussion that we're having on net neutrality. One, a telecommunications service is the sort of the pure communication services. It's a common carrier type of a service. That is the same as the basic services, essentially that evolved out of that definition of a basic service under the computer inquiries. The transmission component. Information services is a definition under the Telecom Act as well, and that is the what evolved out of this definition of an enhanced service, or the data processing component of a service. There's a couple of definitions there for you that provide those definitions from the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996, but as I described them, that's essentially what they mean. So why does
for timekeeping purposes, your first three slides have been 5 minutes. So
all right.
I know you've got 26, so I want to be sure that we get through them. Thank you.
Certainly. Why do these definitions matter? Because information services are regulated under a separate title under the Communications Act called Title I. They are traditionally lightly regulated services, and they are outside the scope of state jurisdiction. Title II services are services that are regulated as common carrier services. These are the communication services that we traditionally have seen as telephone services or the mail services, things like that, common carrier service that we heard earlier the professor referred to. Title II is a part of a law that dates back to the Communications Act of 1934, and it includes a long list of public utility style regulation or common carrier services, some of the provisions of which I've listed there for you in the slides, and you can take a look at those. But importantly, it also included dual state and federal regulation over those services, because the components of those services were easily separated into intrastate, like your local telephone service used to be, and long-distance services, which traditionally were interstate services unless you were making a long-distance call from somewhere within the state of Minnesota to another point in the state of Minnesota. Well, the internet really kind of blew all that up. And the FCC started addressing the question of how we're going to regulate the internet early in the aughts. In 2002, the FCC decided that cable modem service, which is an internet service provided by my clients, was an information service, and it should be lightly regulated under Title I of the Communications Act of 1934. The United States Supreme Court affirmed that decision in a decision called Brand X Services in 2005. The FCC carried that decision that the Internet should be regulated lightly under Title I into a few other orders that would include both telephone companies, wireless services, and anybody essentially that was providing Internet services to the public. In 2005, we first saw the introduction of the principles of what we now sort of commonly understand to be net neutrality, these four guiding openness principles. That Internet policy statement was struck down by the D.C. Circuit in 2010, and then an open Internet order was subsequently adopted by the FCC in 2010 that brought back those three rules. No blocking, no unreasonable discrimination, transparency, themes that we're starting to become familiar with here in the net neutrality debate. But under the Verizon decision in 2010, the D.C. Circuit again decided that because Internet has had been essentially classified as an information service by the FCC, that the FCC had no authority essentially to regulate broadband as a common carrier service, which led to the Open Internet Order of 2015, which reclassified broadband services as a telecommunications service subject to common carrier regulation under Title II. It reversed FCC earlier decisions that broadband service was an information service that should be lightly regulated. The 2015 order also included the three bright line rules, the no blocking, the no throttling, and the no paid prioritization. In 2018, the Ajit Pai FCC repealed that 2015 open Internet order and reclassified Internet service as a Title I communication service as it had been prior to the 2015 order. It again also repealed the three bright line rules, but it preserved the rule about transparency, that ISPs have to be transparent about what their network management practices are. So they have to publish their policy on blocking, throttling, paid prioritization, and affiliated prioritization. A lot of the types of issues that were that have been discussed previously. Their performance characteristics, their commercial terms and conditions of the service have to be disclosed. So why did the FCC in 2018 repeal the Open Internet Order? On balance, the FCC found that research shows that Title II regulation adversely affected broadband investment. It also held that there was regulatory uncertainty about how the Open Internet Order would be implemented, and that dampened enthusiasm for investment. They also found that utility-style regulation was not appropriate for an industry built on innovation and disruption. ISPs also, they found, did not have incentives to block or interfere with content because they are dependent on it to provide service to their customers. Problems identified in the Open Internet Order with ISP gatekeeper functions were overstated. They were not backed by empirical evidence. Some of those same examples were cited to earlier by Mr. Gordon that have been debunked before, both by the FCC and by other organizations that have investigated those cases. They also found that competition would be restrained by anti-competitive behavior by Internet service providers. And they also found to professors, forgot his name again, Constance's point, that the Internet service market was moderately concentrated but not great enough to distort the market conduct. So that decision shifted enforcement over these issues to the Federal Trade Commission, which has the power to police deceptive trade practices and unfair competition. The FTC is empowered to enforce the commitments that ISPs make to their customers. ISPs cannot promise one thing and deliver on another. The disclosure of internet service provider policies is required under the RIF order, and the FTC is responsible for enforcing those laws. States also have the ability to enforce these policies. Antitrust laws also protect competition in this area, including horizontal agreements to block, throttle, or interfere with content, which would potentially be violations of the Sherman Act, and case-by-case enforcement, as opposed to a comprehensive regulatory regime, minimizes the cost of overregulation and avoids painting the entire industry with one brush. I'm going to skip that slide in interest of time. One other aspect of the classification decision is that the FCC maintained its authority to promote broadband deployment, pole attachment regulation, and regulation of state and local right-of-way. Importantly, the FCC in its RIF order preempted state regulation over the internet. It's very clear in the language of the order that any kind of public utility style or economic regulation is preempted. What's not preempted? Traditional state roles to police fraud, issues related to state taxation of commerce done over the internet, and general commercial dealings. States also have the ability to designate companies that are eligible for universal service subsidies, and as I mentioned earlier, pole attachment regulation. The legal authority for preemption, this is an inherently interstate service, and it's also very difficult to determine the beginning and end points of a broadband connection. Since it is such a global service, the FCC has said, since we can't really determine the beginning and end points of each communication, it's an inherently interstate service. It's impossible to determine, and therefore federal jurisdiction prevails. This has been litigated. In fact, in Minnesota, we've had two situations in which our state commerce department has attempted to assert jurisdiction over essentially a very similar service, voice over internet protocol services, and has been twice told by federal courts and the FCC that they have been preempted from regulating in this area.
And just we're getting up on 15 minutes, so if you could maybe use a minute or two to just wrap up your comments, that would be great.
I will close up, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
So what's at stake? What's at stake is how to regulate the internet. In 2018, the International Monetary Fund estimated that the digital sector is responsible for nearly 10% of U.S. GDP. Broadband providers are responsible for $1 billion in investment in Minnesota since 2011. Minnesota's border-to-border broadband fund is a model for the rest of the nation, and this bill fundamentally alters it and creates a major disincentive for private sector participation. The criminalization of a legitimate public policy issue, as is provided for in this bill, around an issue that is greatly misunderstood and subject to misuse and abuse, is unfair. What we need is a national uniform policy that strikes the right balance between regulation and investment. A patchwork of state net neutrality regulations would indeed balkanize the internet while undermining competition, investment, and innovation. States are also ill-equipped with the expertise to regulate the internet, an inherently interstate, highly technical, and complex network of networks. The federal government has also challenged similar legislation that's been adopted in California on the grounds of federal preemption. That legislation was stayed until the challenges to the FCC's RIF order have taken effect and have been run their course. Madam Chair, that's all I have. I appreciate your indulgence and your time, and I'm happy to answer questions at the end of the other presenters.
Thank you. If you could stick around, that would be helpful.
Thanks.
Did you have anything to add?
I do.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Can you be brief?
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Because you're testifying for the same organization,
same
is that correct?
Right.
Okay, so we have another four organizations that want to be heard from, and so I don't want their time to be cut into too much. So
Madam
thank
Chair,
you.
Madam Chair, I will skip over what I can. My name is Anna Borup. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. We serve customers in every corner of the state, metro, suburban, and rural. They represent all sizes of ISPs, large, mid-size, and small. We serve over 1.4 million customers from southern Minnesota to the Thief River Falls Canadian border. So collectively, our members employ about 4,400 Minnesotans with another 36,000 or so on indirect jobs. So in Minnesota, investment, as you know, in broadband has been significant. Minnesota cable companies have invested over $1 billion of private capital into their networks since 2011, expanding internet access and increasing speeds across the state. Let me be clear, all Minnesota cable companies support and strictly adhere to the principles of net neutrality. The principles include no blocking of legal content, no throttling of traffic, no unfair discrimination, and transparent consumer practices. These principles are enshrined in our commitments to our customers. They're also binding and enforceable, as Tony said, by the Federal Trade Commission. And to the author, I hope we agree with you on those principles. And I also want to convey to Representative Stevenson that we think policy questions around net neutrality are fair. As the internet becomes more and more intertwined in our lives, we know sorting out the appropriate role for the government to play in its management is not easy, and we recognize that. And the internet that was once a small dial-up service is now the social and economic force that it is today. And we recognize that it is complex and political, and that's unfortunate. Where we differ is the appropriate place for that policy debate. So state legislative leaders, we believe, can play a meaningful role in this debate by calling for a federal solution. Minnesota cable companies believe a unified national approach is the best path to ensure consistent net neutrality principles. Congress has the power to enshrine these principles in federal law, and all signs point to this being one area the new Congress might actually find common ground, and a meaningful and permanent resolution is overdue. I will skip down. I want to talk about the effects on broadband investment, particularly when it comes to rural ISPs. We're especially proud of those efforts, and we see the proposed regulations before you today, however well-intentioned, as having negative consequences for broadband investment in Minnesota. Data travels without regard for state lines. For a consumer, opening a website or streaming a TV show is a simple action. For operators, not so simple. It's a complex chain of events involving servers, backbones, content delivery networks, and exchange points, steps of which cross multiple state boundaries, making broadband the prime example of an interstate service. So for anything to go wrong on any point of that journey, the operator could be accused of violating state net neutrality laws and face a penalty of perjury. ISPs are extremely diligent in tracking, complying with both federal and state laws, but a minor infraction can be devastating. Internet companies want to continue to make the case for investment in our broadband networks. By creating regulatory uncertainty, you will have a direct and adverse impact on their ability to finance improvement, decrease their ability to innovate, and limit the incentives to offer customers new features and better services. I'll close by saying Minnesota has been a leader and an innovator when it comes to deploying broadband and encouraging investment in the technology sector. An example of this would be the success of Minnesota's broadband grant program, which is encouraging a partnerships between communities, providers, and the state to expand broadband to high-cost, unserved areas of the state. Minnesota cable companies support an open internet. We pledge to work towards the passage of a federal solution, and we'll be happy to work together with the author towards that goal. And so we urge the committee to reject a state approach to net neutrality and instead focus your attention and leadership on supporting public policy that will encourage investment, competition, and innovation. This will ensure Minnesota remains a leader in the area of broadband policy. We've come too far for this progress to be slowed by politics. So I really appreciate the committee's time, and that's it.
Thank you.
Okay.
And if you could stick around for questions. The next testifier is Jim Beatty, BevCom, Minnesota Telecommunications Alliance. And we did allow a fair amount of latitude with the presentation, with the PowerPoint presentation. There was some request for background, so if folks could keep their comments under 5 minutes, we would most greatly appreciate it so we can get to testimony and then go home. We've got the room all night, but we don't want to use it.
Chair Halverson, my testimony is 2 pages. So,
welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
I will take much less than 5 minutes.
You.
Chair Halverson, members of the committee, my name is Jim Beatty, and I am General Counsel and Director of Government Relations for BevCom.
a rural telecommunications provider of telephone, cable TV, and broadband services in several communities in southern Minnesota, including the booming metropolises of Wells, Freeborn, and Pine Island. I also serve as the chair of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance's Legislative Committee, and coincidentally, I am also a proud card-carrying member of the American Civil Liberties Union. I am here testifying today on behalf of my company, as well as other members of MTA, and I thank you for the opportunity to do so. MTA members serve the most rural parts of our state. Bevcom is a fourth-generation family-owned company. Other MTA members are cooperatives, privately held, and publicly traded commercial companies. MTA members have invested just under $115 million in telecommunications infrastructure in 2018 and plan to invest over $122 million in 2019. We serve the hardest to serve customers in this state. We are active partners with the communities that we serve and the Minnesota Office of Broadband Development to see that all Minnesotans will have access to a robust internet service. I am concerned that if this bill passes, it could have a chilling effect on these partnerships, particularly the border-to-border broadband grant program, recognized throughout the country as a model for public-private partnerships in broadband deployment to the most remote and hardest to serve areas of our state. Bevcom and other members of MTA have long been proponents of many of the concepts of net neutrality. Let me be clear, we do not block, we do not throttle, and we do not engage in paid prioritization of lawful internet traffic. So, if we don't do these things, why do we have a problem with this bill? Two reasons. First and foremost, we have issues with the draconian perjury penalty currently in this bill. There are times when ISPs cannot control the internet loads thrust upon our networks. Network management practices help during peak times, but on a snow day in Blue Earth, where I live and work, when school is canceled, as it was yesterday, up to 72% of our network is being consumed by bandwidth-sucking high-definition video content from Netflix and other edge providers. This puts a serious strain on our network. Customer devices may also hinder internet performance. Hacking of a customer's internet or email account can also result in deterioration of internet performance, or in some cases, actual blocking of their internet account. Should the Department of Commerce or the Attorney General commence an investigation against our company, and it's a small company, much time and effort will be expended to prove the innocence of my CEO in a felony perjury case in Ramsey County. It would be our burden to prove that we are engaging in reasonable network management practices or that outside forces caused the performance reduction. Internet service is a contractual relationship governed by civil procedure with the government, private businesses, and our individual customers. Any breach of that contract should result in civil penalties, not a felony conviction, imprisonment of up to 5 years, a fine of up to $10,000, or both, as mandated by this bill. Second, and this has been pointed out before, so I'll be
just
brief.
Just for your information, we've coming up on 5 minutes,
right.
So if you could wrap up
well,
your testimony.
Well, I will not repeat what the others have said about too much about the federal nature of this matter. But I would point out that this law is very similar to a law passed in California. The U.S. Department of Justice has challenged that case based on the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution. In addition, this bill also gives the Department of Commerce enforcement authority over information services, which the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals recently struck down in the charter case. So I will take up any more of your time. I know your time is valuable. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I will be happy to stick around for questions.
Thank you. I'd appreciate it if you could, and thank you again for being mindful of time and getting your information to us. Paul Wirtz, and you can correct my pronunciation when you get to the table, sir. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is Paul Wirtz. As I like to say, Wirtz rhymes with search, so phonetic problems with that from Ellis Island. I am Paul Wirtz. I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota. I represent more than 1,500 employees around the state, AT&T invests more than $100 million a year in Minnesota's economy, and we've invested more than $1 billion since 2010. In 2018 alone, we made over 1,300 network enhancements in communities across Minnesota, including adding new cell sites, expanding LTE, adding network capacity, and deploying small cells. We're already off to a good start in 2019 with network enhancements just announced in the communities of Bok, B-O-C-K, Lake City, NetLake, and Stewartville. I'm very pleased to announce that Minneapolis will be among the first cities in America to get 5G service beginning in 2019. Much of that was a direct result of the bipartisan legislation that emanated from this committee a couple years ago. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to the members about this legislation. Let me open by saying that AT&T is committed to an open internet. We do not block websites. We do not censor online content. We do not throttle, discriminate, or degrade internet traffic, period. We've publicly committed to these principles for more than 10 years, and we will continue to abide by them in order to provide our customers with the open internet experience they've come to expect. These commitments are published on our website. They were reiterated by our chairman, Randall Stevenson. I believe you have that open letter in your packet that was issued last January. And these are certainly enforceable by law. We oppose House File 136 because we believe Congress, not the states, ought to end the debate over internet regulations once and for all by writing new laws that govern the internet and protect consumers. Since 1996, the entire telecommunications and internet providers have invested $1.5 trillion in infrastructure over a 20-year period. Madam Chair, that's kind of the formal part of my comments. I would just like to add a couple of notes. I would like to thank the gentleman from the ACLU. I'm going to date myself. I just marked my 20th service anniversary with AT&T, and in doing that, this is the first time I've ever heard of a rock group being invoked in a telecom issue. I have an explanation about this Pearl Jam issue that came about. This was from a 2007 concert where such groups as G.Love, Special Sauce, and Pete Yorn were part of a Lollapalooza performance. It's my understanding that we retained a vendor to monitor content from nudity or profanity, and there were a couple of lines as Pearl Jam was singing Another Brick in the Wall from another great band, Pink Floyd, that went into some disparaging comments about George Bush. We were very public about that. That was not censorship. That was probably a vendor overstepping its bounds. Finally, I would add that, two more points. One, our assets are Warner Media. We own HBO. Turn on John Oliver or Bill Maher and get their comments on net neutrality, and you can most definitely see that we are not interested in censoring anyone. Finally, I have a few months left of the current broadband task force. I think my term expires in April, pending any renewal of that. I can tell you in the last 5 years that I've been on that task force, the subject of net neutrality has never come up. That's not reflected in any of the reports that have been issued. It's not been reflected in any comments by people talking or small business talking about the need for broadband and how that is an impediment. It just has not come up. It's about getting broadband funding, keeping the grant program going, and I would just put that out there. We've made a number of policy recommendations over the last 5 years and very strenuous debate with a lot of people that don't see eye to eye, but we come out with a consensus, and that is just something that's never come up. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Wirtz, for your testimony. And if you could stick around for questions later, that would be helpful. John Dukich.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Dukich.
Thank you.
It happens. I'm with the Minnesota High Tech Association, and for those of you who don't know us, we are a trade association representing about 300 science and technology companies from across the state. You should find in your packets a letter from our organization stating our position on internet regulation. And so I'll keep my comments brief, but I do want to highlight a few points. First, we believe that regulation of the internet should occur at the federal level. A key component to fostering a vibrant technology ecosystem is a clear, consistent set of rules governing the conduct of business, governmental entities, and citizens. And this holds for the internet as well. There's been too much inconsistency in the rules and policies governing the internet, varying with the changes in leadership at the Federal Communications Commission, and enacting state-based laws and regulations governing the Internet only exacerbates these inconsistencies, creating a patchwork of laws and regulations across states for what is ultimately an interstate and global issue. Inconsistencies in the regulatory framework of the Internet hinders the deployment of advanced communications technologies and applications that rely on these technologies. As states like Minnesota work to expand access to broadband through public-private partnerships, we must make sure that we optimize the return on those investments while also encouraging deployment and development of novel technologies. And there are a number of ways to do this, but providing regulatory certainty and legal certainty to broadband providers is among them. And only Congress can really provide this level of certainty. So we feel that if legislation like House File 136 become law, we are concerned about the negative impact that it could have on Minnesota's technology ecosystem. If broadband providers pull back on their investment, it will have a negative impact not only on them, but on the businesses that rely on broadband to reach new markets and new customers, and on those businesses that develop technologies that require an Internet connection, like in the connected vehicles and telemedicine space. Minnesota's IT sector accounts for about 8.6% of Minnesota's economy, and the technology sector here employs about 250,000 people, paying an average annual wage of about $98,000, which is approximately 75% more than the state's private sector wage. So we don't want to see high-paying jobs move to other states or lose out on economic development and additional job creation that would occur if not for this type of state-based approach to Internet regulation. The issue around Internet policy and regulation is much broader than any one state and should be addressed at the federal level. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate your time. And we'll ask Representative Stevenson to come back to the table. We can begin member discussion. And I know Representative Stevenson.
May I make a brief remark?
Yes.
I just wanted to comment on a couple things and clear up a couple things. The first of all, I think you saw a trend in some of the testifiers here discussing about how the industry would really like to see this regulated at the federal level and views that as a possibility coming forward. In fact, we had one testifier pledge to work towards that end from MCCA. And I am really encouraged by that because I think that it would be great to have a federal standard. But I think that MCCA needs to talk to its members about this because I don't think that they all are on the same page about this. I would note that according to federal open government records, that one member of MCCA spent $30,000 a quarter on one lobbyist opposing legislation in the Congress that would have achieved a federal standard on net neutrality. And I don't share the optimism of that several testifiers expressed that there's going to be a bipartisan solution on net neutrality on this Congress which can't seem to keep the government open for more than 3 weeks at a time. I don't expect that anything is going to happen on the federal level meaningful, and I don't think that that is cynical. I think that's reality. I also wanted to briefly mention that the concern about a patchwork, because there's not going to be action on the federal level, we're going to have a patchwork. As Mr. Gordon mentioned, other states have already moved and have already enacted laws, and a lot of states have also taken executive action. So there's going to be a patchwork. So the question before the committee isn't whether to create a patchwork or not, it's whether Minnesotans are going to be protected or not. And that's what we have to decide. And the very last thing I want to briefly mention, one of the testifiers expressed concern about the perjury language in there and made the penalty of perjury and made two comments that I just want to clarify with. First of all, the testifier said that they would have the burden to prove that they didn't do anything wrong. I can tell you as a prosecutor that is not accurate. The state would have the burden of proof, just like do in any proceeding. And that proof would have to be beyond a reasonable doubt. And so that is not that's not accurate to say that. He also made allusions to defending the CEO, and I this just might be a misconception, but the language in the statute is very clear that it would be the company that would be liable, not an individual. And A few people have asked me about that before this hearing, and I'll make the same commitment publicly on the record that I made to those people privately, which is that if anyone can establish to me that by authority this language does place an individual person in criminal jeopardy, I would happily amend the statute to rectify that. The idea is to hold the company accountable, not send individuals to jail. So I just wanted to clarify on those three points.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. And I see that we have a handful of amendments. Can we, does anybody want to lay claim to some amendments and move things? I see an A2 amendment. Is that somebody's? Representative Lisplegard?
Can I ask a question before we go there?
Sure. Representative Lisplegard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this probably would be for Paul Wartz from.
Oh, Representative Lisplegard, we're going to do a discussion after we finish the amendments,
okay,
if that's okay with you. I've got a little list going, so thank you. Appreciate that. A2? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just feel like we're doing this a little bit premature in that we should be waiting to hear what's happening with some of the other cases that are happening. So A2 is very simple. It changes the effective date so that the bill is effective after the FCC and the U.S. Attorney General have provided written advice to the Department of Commerce so that this bill does not violate any existing federal law, rule, or regulation.
And Representative Tice, did you want to formally move that in front of us? I didn't.
I would love to.
Okay. Representative Tice moves the A2 amendment. Representative Stevenson to the amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the author's amendment at the beginning of our discussion today changed the effective date to August 1st. There's presently a lot of litigation, as was commented on this, but most of that should be concluded by the time August 1st gets around. I would oppose the amendment.
Thank you. Any further discussion? The amendment. Representative Tice moved the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, no?
No.
The amendment does not prevail, and it is not adopted. Next, we have the I'm out of order, 3. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is again on the same idea as Representative Tice's amendment. There is still pending litigation on this, and my understanding is that the bill that's before us is modeled after the state of California's bill, which is in litigation right now. And I just would like to make sure that we don't put something on the books here in Minnesota that conflicts with what a court case may be. So we're just asking for the prudent thing to do, which is to delay the implementation of any law or regulation that may come down related to this matter until after it's been fully adjudicated. And certainly I would expect that members can see the wisdom of doing something like that, because if we are in conflict in state statute at the time that this is adjudicated, we will probably not be in session. I don't know if this rises to the issue of a governor's special session, but a shortage of beer in the state of Minnesota at one time did cause a special session. So I will just defer back to that, Madam Chair. And I do formally move the A3 amendment for consideration and urge members support, please.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the A3 amendment and scares us all with tales of beer shortages. any discussion to the A3 amendment? Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, I would oppose this amendment for the same reasons I opposed the last amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, then I would like a roll call on this, please.
A roll call has been requested. Any further discussion to the amendment? All right. With that, the clerk will take the roll.
Halverson?
No.
Stevenson?
No.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Carlson?
No.
Davids?
Yes.
Dean?
No.
Elkins?
No.
Garofalo?
Yes.
Haley?
Yes.
Howard?
No.
Katiza Watun?
No.
Kreisha?
Yes.
Lesh? Lisplegard?
No.
Mahoney?
No.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Richardson?
No.
Suzinski?
Yep.
Tapke?
No.
Tice?
There being 8 ayes and 11 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Would somebody like to offer the A4 amendment. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, I did put a contingency plan together today in the unlikely event that Amendments 2 and 3 did not prevail. And item 4, unfortunately, we have to go to this direction. It makes a contingency plan that if during the time that the legislature is not in session and the fact that this bill becomes law, that there would be money available to defend the state of Minnesota in similar litigation that the state of California finds itself in. So, Madam Chair, before I offer the amendment, would it be appropriate to maybe offer an oral amendment to the amendment, or did you want to move the amendment before I offered the oral amendment?
Representative O'Driscoll, we need to have the amendment in front of us to further amend it. So
okay,
like
then
to
I will move
that.
The A4 amendment, Madam Chair, and then I'd like to offer a potential oral amendment.
Representative O'Driscoll, if you want to talk about your oral amendment.
I do, and it's to the bill author. I'm going to ask him to help me to fill in the number that we should be looking at for potential litigation should the state of Minnesota find itself, and then based on the author's recommendation, I'll take that into consideration as to what the oral amendment might be. Madam Chair?
And Representative O'Driscoll, I do want to remind you that this is not a finance committee, and I want to be sure that we're staying within our jurisdiction. If you wanted to move an appropriation, perhaps the finance committee would be a better time to have that discussion. And in the interest of time, I'd ask you to consider that. But
Madam Chair, with all due respect, there are no germaneness issues in committee. There are on the floor relating to bills. And so if you're going to deny the hearing on or the consideration of the AO4 amendment, I guess that's within your purview, but do remember that there are no germaneness issues as it relates to committees. And I found that out the hard way once when I raised that issue with a former chair by the name of Atkins. And so that was always stuck in the back of my mind, and I was actually in this committee. So I had to do with a similar topic. So I will defer to your ruling on it, but there is past chair precedent telling me that there is no issues of germaneness. So
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, seeing so I believe my finance committee is the finance committee for commerce, I would certainly go with the vote in my committee, but as the chairman, I see no reason to put any money into this, even when it comes to my committee, because the state of Minnesota can certainly ask its attorney general, who is eminently competent in getting in a fight, could certainly pay for this for the 6 or 8 months before we get back in charge or back in session.
Same difference.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate Chair Mahoney's comments, yes, and I was going to ask him if he would like to offer a number, but he's in his comments said he doesn't feel that the state of Minnesota, that the Attorney General's office is properly funded to be able to defend the state of Minnesota in such a measure. I guess one of the things that I will ask is I would like to put $1 million in here as the oral amendment.
And Representative O'Driscoll, is that you're moving an oral amendment for $1 million?
Yep, and that would go into both the provision before 2020 and 2021. And I would ask for a roll call, and I would also make the comment that previous bill authors who have carried this bill have been very, very careful to remind members in the legislature that it's not prudent for the legislature to pass laws when there's pending litigation on those matters that are before the committee. So I will also ask the committee to take that into consideration this afternoon as well. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like a roll call, please.
Representative Stevenson, a question I have for you is, have you asked for a fiscal analysis of your bill, and is this amendment in keeping with that fiscal analysis?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. Yes, I did request a fiscal note. That request was returned as indicating there is not a cost to the bill, and so a note would not be prepared. After seeing Representative Driscoll's amendment earlier today, we reached out to the Attorney General's office again, and again they indicated that there would not be a cost, that there should not be a further appropriation for this bill. So I would oppose Representative O'Driscoll's motion on the basis of the fiscal note request and the comments of the Attorney General's office.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I guess I would just use that as an incorporation. I guess technically wouldn't have had to have been an oral amendment, so I would just incorporate those numbers. So we can just vote on the A4 amendment with those as incorporation.
Okay, we can incorporate those. And I want to just make sure that our nonpartisan staff has that. Okay, very good. Does anybody need that read back to them, or are we understanding where we're plugging in that number? Very good. Roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
All right. Halverson?
No.
Stevenson?
No.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Carlson?
No.
Davids?
Yes.
Dean?
No.
Elkins?
No.
Garofalo?
Yes.
Haley?
Yes.
Howard?
No.
Katiza Watoon?
No.
Kreisha?
Yes.
Lesh? Lislegard?
No.
Mahoney?
No.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Richardson?
No.
Suzinski?
Yes.
Tapke?
No.
Tice?
Yes.
There being 8 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. We see the A5 amendment. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Stevenson, for the bill. This is a very complex issue, and you're tackling, you're tackling a mammoth of an issue. Let me tell you how this amendment came to be. It wasn't just something we thought up. Did you get a chance to call through the broadband grant recipients at all as you were preparing for this?
Representative Stevenson.
Representative Kreisha, a few of them I spoke to in my office. I didn't call through a list, but I have spoken to some, yes.
Okay. And in
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in doing that, I did as well. And I was asking them some of the issues with this. And I don't know if any of those issues were raised with you, but one of those that was raised with me was the edge provider. The idea that a content provider, and I did not know this before I had called through, like ESPN 360, which is completely an internet content service, is only provided through the internet. And what these edge providers are starting to do is charge access fees. So if you are an ISP, such as Albany Mutual, and somebody in that area decides they want to get internet or ESPN 360, they can subscribe to that. And it looks like your bill gives... everyone has to have equal access. So if you're inside Albany Mutual and you want ESPN 360, the ISP has to provide that, I believe, what you're doing here. However, ESPN 360, charges a quarter access fee for every subscriber, even though only one user may have that underneath. Does your bill address that? Because that's not a form of throttling, but it is a new form of a content provider being able to push upstream how they're going to get their services in. I thought it was actually a very unique situation that if I'm a content provider and I can get access to 100,000 people in the network and only two of them are going to use it, and I make them pay for all the subscribers, that's a pretty good amount of money. Does your bill address that and give ISPs the ability to control that?
And Representative Stevenson, before you answer, I was calling for the A5 amendment.
And this is pertaining to that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not going off track. There's a reason.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kreisha, that's a great question, honestly. I think as you look at the text of the bill, I don't think it would require the ISP to provide that service if they're paying a fee for a few different reasons, including that it allows them to continue to manage content under reasonable network management. And I think that is a reasonable sort of content-neutral management. It's based on the cost that the service provider is providing, and not, you know, the fact that it's sports programming or that's ESPN as opposed to Fox Sports Network. But I think it's also worth an additional look. This bill has another committee stop after this, and I will look into that further to make sure that the bill addresses that concern, because I think that is a reasonable concern that you raise.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. And I'm being dead serious on this, because as I was talking to this ISP, I started to think this through. I thought, okay, so if ESPN 360 charges a quarter per subscriber, and we've already heard lots of testimony that a lot of this can be profit driven, what stops a pornography provider from charging a buck a user? And suddenly, as I started going through this list and calling Arvig, Albany Mutual, I started to think, wow, talk about really hitting our smallest rural providers. What I would offer to you is, I won't ask for a roll call if you'll take this amendment and work on this between the next two stops. I'm really serious about this. I mean, you're going to put some ISPs in some really tough spots, because we haven't figured out how we're going to control that kind of extortion, if you will. I mean, we So your thoughts, I mean, if you're serious about working on this, I think it would be a good place for you to go.
Representative Creech, I think we're always serious, but we will ask Representative Stevenson.
I just want to emphasize that.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Creech, I want you to remember this moment and take delight in it when I said I thought this was a good amendment even before your comments, and I think so now, and so I will accept it.
Thank you.
It's a friendly amendment, and I appreciate your comments.
So, Representative Creech, would you like to formally...
Hold on to that moment.
That was a great buildup. Would you like to move that A5 amendment, and so it's in front of us?
I would like to move the A5 amendment, and... thank you for taking it, and if you want, I'm happy to work on that with you on that amendment, because I really do think it is a hindrance.
Representative Creech moves the A5 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevail. The amendment is adopted. To the bill as amended. Representative Creech, you're first on the list.
Yes, thank you. And you know what? This is perfect. It'll transition me back to the edge provider concerns. And Representative Stevenson, you've acknowledged an openness to get to good policy. I used to work in schools in IT, and I was thinking about edge providers. Little Falls School District provides, they send out streaming of wrestling events, school events, and all. They are now an edge provider. And if I'm running that network, am I allowed to hold the port speed down so that I don't blow up my servers? And do the ISPs become responsible for that? Does your bill address that?
Representative Stevenson.
Representative Creech, I think that in terms of what the bill regulates what ISPs can do in terms of blocking and throttling, not what edge providers are doing.
President Creesha.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'll bring this back. I'm sure there's other questions. So here's my concerns, and here's where I see things are starting to get. What you said is where you're purposely going with the bill. Here's where the concern I have. Now you have providers who may not know the answer to that question. They're a small provider. They don't have a big legal firm, and so there's uncertainty. So I pose the question to some of them. You're an ISP provider. You are applying for the broadband grant. In this bill, if you violate these or it's determined that there's a violation of this, maybe your school throttled this and you didn't know unwillingly, and you go back and forth, under this bill, under subdivision or under 2.28, you now have to unilaterally terminate the contract with the Office of Broadband. You have to return any of the funds, you have to give the money back, and any revenues that you've earned. So you have an ISP that's trying to expand into a rural area like mine. They've started this. They started plowing the fiber. Something happens. They now get into lawsuit. Do they stop? Is there a cease and desist as they go through the discovery and all that? And do they have to start accounting for the revenues? And then as I'm asking the Internet service providers this, I said, okay, how does this work for you if you don't know? And the two answers I got unequivocally was, we just may not apply for the grant program because I put 50% down. I may not get that money back for 10 years. So now that I don't know the ROI and the longevity, this may deter me from actually going and seeking broadband. So I don't think that's the purpose, and I don't think that's the intent. But I think we should make it very clear that these small providers are not going to be in a situation where that's going to create uncertainty for them where they say, I don't think I want to participate in this because of the uncertainty. So, you know, if you want to respond to that, great. But I do believe as I went through all these providers and I talked to at least three of them today, that uncertainty needs to be removed or we're going to hold back investment into rural Minnesota. Those are just my comments.
Representative Mahoney, you had a comment to this point?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and seeing as how we're trying to talk the bill to death, I might want to just add my comments here. Having sat on the committee that funded the broadband task force for the last 4 years and been the author of a number of bills that increased the funding so that we could have been all done with it, I would suspect that there's more that as a partisan issue, it was... you should be happy if all those providers aren't taking up on the grants because I could never get a hearing on my bill. I could never get a vote on the floor on my bill. You know, no one wanted to spend the money, and we're hoping that Representative Pawlowski will take a different tact and put a substantial amount of money in so that these providers can get to the last mile. It was always a fun fight because, you know, the person I was fighting with the most is a pretty sharp guy and has a good sharp tongue, but I always lost when I tried to put more money on and get it done. So it would seem that it was might have been a partisan issue then. I'm not sure what it is going to be now.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Grisha, I want to be really clear that I think that the law, the bill that I'm putting before you is actually very clear that it applies only to Internet service providers in terms of what they can block and throttle and not edge providers. But I also think that if there's a way that we can craft some language that further provides that clarity, I'm open to having that discussion with you. And as I said before, this bill has at least one more committee stop, and I'm happy to have that communication, that conversation with you and work with you in between now and the next stop to see if we can't find something that works.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, just I need to follow up on.
And I'm going to just quickly. So we're going to come up on our end time. We can go another 15 minutes. I've got five more people to ask questions on the list. I did provide some pretty strong latitude early in the hearing so that we got some background as was requested from the industry, and so we'll go a little bit over. I would prefer not to come back, but we do have the room tonight if need be. So Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to comment, I appreciate Chair Mahoney's comments. However, the intent is not to talk this to death, folks. Folks, 500 pages on the FCC ruling. You see the tabs? I read them. I have done the homework. This is complicated stuff. I'm not here trying to kill your bill. I'm here trying to protect the interests of a broadband program, frankly, that I have fought for 6 years against members of my own caucus, and I have a $100 million broadband bill being introduced this week. My job is to get broadband into rural Minnesota, not to talk this to death. The last thing I want is we get into the broadband program that is dwindling, and someone goes, thank goodness we killed that. Because if that's the attitude, then the gigabyte economy doesn't come to Little Falls, Minnesota. That's why I'm here. And I apologize if you think I'm trying to talk this to death. I'm just really informed and trying to get to this policy. So I'll let other members, and I'm sorry there's time constraints, but frankly, Madam Chair, this is very complicated, and to only spend an hour and a half is a bit disappointing.
Thank you, Representative Grisha. Representative Howard.
I'll be quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. A few of my questions have been answered. Quickly, I know that Representative Davids has been prolific at coming up with names of songs to be named after bills, and just hearing about the Pearl Jam issue, this could be the Even Flow bill. but I guess not a lot of Pearl Jam fans in the House. Just quickly, thank you, Representative Stevens, for bringing the bill forward. I think it's a basic freedom of speech issue, and you spoke well on it. You know, large, powerful interests control this space, and so we need to be looking out for Minnesotans' interests, and that's what I think this bill does. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Howard. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to express some concerns about a trend I've seen in committees so far this year. We're questioning entities' intentions. That's a very dangerous road to go, and Representative Stevenson just did it today, talking about lobbying contracts. Members, and not just in this committee, in other committees, are trying to degrade testifiers that they disagree with. That's a very dangerous road to go because, as I've said before, today's opponent could be tomorrow's friend. We're questioning intentions. It's against House rules. It's against Masons. So, Madam Chair, every bill that goes through, are we going to have to hear about lobbying contracts? Because I believe it's tremendously unseemly, inappropriate, and ungentlemanly behavior. So I hope it stops right now. It's been really bad in some committees, not so bad in here, but we don't refer to lobbying contracts in this committee. We just don't do that. So let's step it up. Let's step our game up a little bit and get to the issues, talk about the issues, and not about who's doing what to whom. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of my question was addressed in Representative Creech's remarks, but I do want to go on record about also being very concerned about the impact of this bill for rural Minnesota. I represent areas that are still not served, not just underserved, but not served at all with broadband, and particularly in the last 2 weeks when students have not been able to get to school and we're trying to promote e-learning, We cannot put things into place, utility-style regulation, that will hamper innovation, that will hamper investment, and promote a gig economy. So, again, just want to go on record with the comments that Representative Kreischer made and the impact it would have to my communities, and I hope you can address those issues with further work on the bill.
Representative Stevenson, any follow-up?
The only thing that I would say is I do intend to work with Representative Kreischer on this, but I think that net neutrality legislation is uniquely important for rural communities and small communities, because when they have internet service, it's usually one ISP. Where I live, I've got a few to choose from. If one is engaging in behavior I don't like, I can go to another one. In a rural community where there's one ISP and they control the show, if they engage in some of the behavior in this bill, the consumer has no recourse. They have to live with it. And I want every Minnesotan to have access to a full, fair, and open internet. And I think that that's what this bill is about. We absolutely need to make sure that this doesn't hurt the broadband investments, and I'll work with Representative Kreischer on that.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for being the instant fact check for members of the committee. First of all, Representative Kreischer, no ISP is going to get damaged by this bill, because this bill has zero chance of becoming law. Okay, it's a waste of time. The committee should be spending time on more important things like legalizing sports gambling in the state of Minnesota, Madam Chair.
God, I was hoping he was going to say marijuana.
Oh, yeah. Well, if this session keeps up, maybe I'll be there on that one. So, Madam Chair and members, because this broadband issue has been brought up, suburban Democrats, please don't let them snooker you into funding this broadband stuff. This is a total waste of money. Of the things the state of Minnesota spends money on, it's one of the biggest boondoggles. Please listen to the folks who can explain to you the CAF funding, the CAF II funding, the private sector investment that's going in place. This is a complete waste of money. Go ahead and spend the money on other stuff. Just please don't spend it on this. I had to carry this stuff the last 4 years, and it hurt me every time. Next, it's been brought up that there is a locations where there's only one provider in Minnesota, or there's unserved areas. Madam Chair, members, as a matter of fact, using the statutory definitions of what unserved and underserved are, there are no unserved locations in the state of Minnesota, period. Okay? Everybody in the state of Minnesota has access to more than one provider using the statutory definitions of unserved. If you dispute that, you can talk to your nonpartisan research, or again, the cadre of government affairs folks who can give you that, give you those facts. To the author of the bill, I'm glad to see that you included subdivision 3 in the bill, so that regarding emergency communications, for those that don't know, a lot of the ISP involvement and provider involvement was as a result of 9/11, where even the President of the United States, when the 9/11 crisis was happening, was unable to get reliable communications and access. So I'm very happy to see that you included in that. To the author, I have a couple of questions, one really quick. Is your intent to include satellite internet in this or not? As I read the language, it doesn't look like you do, but can you just clarify your intent on that?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I agree with you that the current language does not include satellite internet. As to my intent, I would say that I intended not to at this point, but it's an interesting question that I'd like to think a little bit more about as well.
So, Madam Chair, and to the author, why did you not include satellite internet?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, you know, honestly, part of the reason why was because I do think that we should have consistent standards across the country. This legislation is modeled after what has been adopted in other states.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, members, just to be clear, the consumer protection language we've heard about, the urgent need, does not apply to any customer in Minnesota who has satellite for their internet.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I think that it's worth thinking more about that. As I said a minute ago, the current bill language doesn't apply to satellite internet.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, members, there are other flaws with this bill that I would point out. For example, on page 2, you will notice that the ability of edge providers to provide lawful internet content, there's no delineation between that language that determines what is lawful and what is actually harmful to the provider. Just because something is lawful does not mean that it can't render the network disruptive or potentially cause problems with things like routing protocols. A little bit of network engineering nerddom there. But, again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because this bill is not going to become law. So
members, I would urge you to vote no, but more importantly, I would encourage my freshman suburban DFL colleagues, please read up on this broadband program, and if you want to know more about it, I am happy to sit down with you over a cup of coffee or lunch and tell you why you should never vote for that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. And I do want to follow up and just state that there are many of us, I have traveled the state myself and heard about people who state they are not served by broadband. And when you're talking to consumers who want to, you know, retire in greater Minnesota and sell stuff over the internet and they can't do it, you know, the craft economy is booming, and for a lot of people who are whittling or brewing or doing whatever. When they tell me directly, we have to recognize that.
And Madam Chair, I don't want to instantly
Representative Garofalo.
You're the chair, but there's a lot of people out there who think that we never landed on the moon. Okay, they're wrong. Okay?
Say you two, we have the room provided for tonight.
Right,
Madam Chair,
every Minnesotan has access to high-speed internet via at least three satellite providers, no matter where they're at. And those definitions of what high-speed internet are available to everybody. So, yes, they may not have a fiber hookup to their door, but fixed wireless and satellite is available to every Minnesotan right now. So I don't want to – you're the chair, so, of course, you're always right. But on this matter, again, people should consult nonpartisan research and see what their answer is. Thank you.
We'll consult Minnesotans as well. Representative Stevenson. Oh, do we have anybody else on the list?
Nope.
We do not. Representative Stevenson, do you want to make some closing comments? And thank you, everybody, for the discussion. Appreciate everybody's time in staying a little late. Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, just very briefly, I appreciate the animated discussion we've had today. I think it's been constructive. I think that we have some good things to work on before the next committee stop, and I appreciate the comments and construction from the members of the committee and the public on this. I do believe this is a critical consumer protection issue. I want Minnesotans to be protected, and I'd ask for members to vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Is there any further discussion before we move to a vote? With that, Representative Stevenson renews his motion to re-refer House File 136 as amended to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. You're on your way, sir. Thank you, everybody, and we are adjourned.